Welcome to Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales, your getaway to the eerie and the unknown. I'm your host, the Tale Teller, guiding you through the shadowy corridors of the day's spine-chilling narratives. Prepare yourself for tales that will haunt your thoughts and stir your imagination. Well, these are old-school tales, so maybe some horror nostalgia is better coined or served up here. First, we delve into the chilling narrative of The Phantom Hag. Picture a desolate plain in the heart of France where the wind howl through ancient druidical stones. Our protagonist, while visiting friends, encountered a spectral hag with a corpse-like pallor. During a return journey, the apparition makes her presence felt with a ghostly grip that leaves tangible evidence. And I'll leave that summary there. And next we explore the Phantom Woman. In this story, lawyer Gilbert Dent finds himself captivated by a mysterious woman in an abandoned house. Despite warning that she might be a figment of his imagination, Dent's obsession grows. Even a retreat to Brighton can't sever his connection to this ghostly figure, this ghostly love. With the climax arriving at the cliff's edge, quite literally, Dent's life is never the same. And again, I'll leave it there for now. And lastly, we uncover the haunting tale from the tomb. A father and daughter arrive at a hotel seeking healing waters. The father recounts a harrowing experience. His daughter, mistakenly declared dead, was buried alive and later revived by grave robbers. It's a horrific ordeal and one that I think you'll all enjoy. It has a lovely twist at the end as well. So join me, the Tale Teller, as we navigate these stories of spectral encounters and ghostly mysteries and prime yourself ready for the world of the supernatural. Pour yourself a cup of tea, turn the lights off and the sound up, and let's listen to three stories written in 1904. Can you imagine? Enjoy. The Phantom Woman. He took an all-possessing, burning fancy to her from the first. She was neither young nor pretty, so far as he could see, but she was wrapped around with mystery. That was the key of it all. She was noticeable in spite of herself. Her face at the window, sunset after sunset, her eyes gazing out mournfully through the dusty panes, hypnotizing the lawyer. He saw her through the twilight night after night, and he grew at length to wait through the days in a feverish waiting for dusk, and that one look at an unknown woman. She was always at the same window on the ground floor, sitting, doing nothing. She looked beyond, so the infatuated solicitor fancied at him. Once he even thought that he detected the ghost of a friendly smile on her lips. Their eyes always met with a mute desire to make acquaintance. This romance went on for a couple of months. Gilbert Dent assured himself that nothing in his life can possibly remain stationary, and he cudgeled his brain for a respectable manner of introducing himself to his idol. He had hardly arrived at this point when he received a shock. There came an evening when she was not at the window. Next morning, he walked down Wood Lane on his way to the office. He always went by train. But he felt a strong disinclination to go through another day without a sight of her. His heart began to beat like a schoolgirl's as he drew near the house. If she would be at the window. He was almost disposed to take his courage in his hand and call on her, and yes, even tell her in a quick burst that she had mysteriously become all the world to him. He could see nothing ridiculous in this course. The possibility of her being married or having family ties of any sort had simply never occurred to him. However, she was not at the window. What was more, there was a sinister silence, a sort of breathlessness about the whole place. It was a very hot morning in late August. He looked a long time, but no face came and no movement stirred the house. He went his way, walking like a man who has been heavily knocked on the brow and sees stars still. That afternoon he left the office early, and in less than an hour stood at the gate again. The window was blank. He pushed the gate back it hung on one hinge, and walked up the drive to the door. There were five steps leading up to it. At the foot, he wheeled aside sharply to the window. He had a sick dread of looking through the small panes. Why, he could not have told. When at last he found courage to look, he saw that there was a small round table set just under the window. A work table to all appearance, one of those things with lots of little compartments all around and a lid in the middle which shut over a well-like cavity for holding pieces of needlework. He remembered that his mother had one 30 years before. Round the edge of the table was gripped a small, delicate hand. Gilbert Dent's eyes ran from this bloodless hand and slim wrist to a shoulder under a coarse stuff bodice, to a rather wasted throat, which was bare and flung back. So this was the end, before the beginning. He saw her. She was dead, twisted on the floor with a ghastly face turned up towards the ceiling, and stiff fingers caught in desperation round the work table. He stumbled away, along the path and into the lane. For a long time he could not realize the horror of this thing. The influence of the decayed house hung over him. Nothing seemed real. It was quite dark when he moved away from the gate and went into the direction of the nearest police station, that she was dead. This woman, whose very name he did not know, although she influenced him so powerfully, he was certain one look at the face would have told anyone that. That she was murdered, he more than suspected. He had seen no blood about, there had been no mark on the long, bare throat, and yet the word rushed in his ears. Murder. Later on, he went back with the police officer. They broke into the house and entered the room. It was in utter darkness, of course, by now. Dent, his fingers trembling, struck a match. It flared the walls around and lighted them for a moment before he let it fall on the dusty floor. The policeman began to light his lantern and turned it stolidly on the window. He had no reason for delay. He was eager to get to the bottom of business. His professional zeal was whetted. This promised to be a mystery with a spice in it. He turned the light full on the window. He gave a strange, choked cry, half of rage, half of apprehension. Then he went up to Gilbert Dent, who stood in the middle of the room with his hands before his eyes. He took his shoulder and shook it none too gently. "There ain't nobody," he said. Dent looked wildly at the window. The recess was empty except for the work table. The woman was gone. They searched the house. They minutely inspected the garden. Everything was normal. Everything told the same mournful tale of desolation, of death, and long empty years. But they found no woman, no trace of one. "This house," said the policeman, looking suspiciously into the lawyer's face, "has been empty for longer than I can remember. Nobody will live in it. They do say something about foul play, and a good many years ago. I don't know about that, but all I do know is that the landlord can't get it off his hands." It was doubtful if Gilbert Dent heard one word of what the man was saying. He was so stunned to anything but creep home, when he was allowed to go, and let himself stealthily into his own house with a latchkey. He was afraid even of himself. He did not go to bed that night. As for the mystery of the woman, the matter was allowed to drop. It ended, officially. There was a shrug and a grin at the police station. The impression there was that the lawyer had been drinking, that the dead woman in the empty room was a gruesome freak of his tipsy brain. Chapter 2. A week or so later, Dent called on his brother Ned, the one near relation he had. Ned was a doctor. Perhaps he was a shade more matter-of-fact than Gilbert, at all events. When the latter told his story of the house and the woman, he attributed the affair solely to liver. "You're overworked." The elder brother looked at the younger's yellow face. "An experience of this nature is by no means uncommon. Haven't you heard of people having their pet spooks?" But this was a real woman, he declared. I was in love with her. I had made my mind up to marry her, if I could. Ned gave him a keen, swift glance. We'll go to Brighton tomorrow, he said with a quiet decision. As for your work, everything must be put aside. You've run completely down. You ought to have been taken in hand before. They went to Brighton, and it really seemed as if Ned was right, and that the woman at the window had been merely a nervous creation. It seemed so, that is, for nearly 3 weeks, and then the climax came. It was in the twilight. She had always been part of it, that Gilbert Dent saw her again, the woman that had been found lying dead. They were walking, the two brothers, along the cliffs. The wind was blowing in their faces. The sea was booming beneath the cliff. Ned had just said it was about time they turned back to the hotel and had some dinner, when Gilbert, with a cry, leapt forward to the very edge of the flat grass path on which they were strolling. The movement was so sudden that his brother barely caught him in time. They struggled and swayed on the very edge of the cliff for a second. Gilbert, possessed by some sudden frenzy, seemed resolved to go over, but the other at last dragged him backward, and they rolled together on the close, thick turf. At this point, Gilbert opened his eyes and tried to get on his feet. "Better?" asked his brother, cheerfully holding out a helping hand. "Strange. The sea has that effect on some people. Didn't think you were one of them." "What effect?" "Vertigo, my dear fellow." "Ned," said the other solemnly, "I saw her. It is not worth your while to try to account for anything. I have been inclined to think that you were right, that she, the woman at the window, was a fancy, that I had fallen in love with the creation of my own brain. But I saw her again tonight. You must have seen her yourself. She was within a couple of feet of you. Why did you not try and save her? It was nothing short of murder to let her go over like that. I did my best."
"You certainly did, to kill us both," said Ned grimly.
Gilbert gave him a wild look. After luncheon, Ned persuaded him to rest, watched him fall asleep, and then went out. In the porch of the hotel, he was met by a waiter on his return, who told him that Gilbert had left about a quarter of an hour after he had let himself out. Directly he heard this, he feared the worst, having, as is usual in such cases, a very hazy idea of what the worst might be. Of course, he must follow without a moment's delay, but a reference to the timetable told him that there was not another train for an hour, and that was slow. It was already getting dusk when he arrived there. He felt certain that Gilbert would go there. He got to the end of the lane and walked up it slowly, examining every house. There would be no difficulty in recognizing the one he wanted. Gilbert had described it in detail more than once. He stood outside the loosely hanging gate at last and stared through the darkness at the shabby stucco front and rank garden. He went down a flight of steps to the back door and, finding it unfastened, stepped into a stone passage. It was one of the problems of the place that he should have avoided the main entrance door with a half-admitted dread, and that, only half-admitted still, he was afraid to mount the long flight of stone stairs leading from the servants' quarters. However, he pulled himself together and went up to the room. It was dark inside. He heard something scuttle across the floor. He felt the grit and dust of years under his feet. He struck a match, just as Gilbert had done, and looked first at the recess in which the window was built. The match flared around the room for a moment and gave him a flash picture of his surroundings. He saw the stripes of gaudy paper moving almost imperceptibly, like tentacles of some sea monster from the wall. He saw a creature. It looked like a rat, scurrying across the floor from the window to the great mantelpiece of hard white marble. if he had seen nothing more than this. He saw in detail all that the first match had flashed at him. He saw his brother lying on the floor. A ghastly coincidence. His hand was caught round the edge of the work table as hers had been. The other hand was clenched across his breast. There was a look of great agony on his face. A dead face, of course. This was the end of the affair. He was lying dead by the window where the woman had sat every night at dusk and smiled at him. The second match went out. The brother of the dead man struck a third. He looked again and closely. Then he staggered to his feet and gave a cry. It rang through the empty rooms and echoed without wearying down the long stone passages in the basement. Gilbert's head was thrown back. His chin peaked to the ceiling. On his throat were livid marks. The doctor saw them distinctly. He saw the grip of small fingers, the distinct impression of a woman's little hand. The curious thing about the whole story, the most curious thing perhaps, is that no other eye ever saw those murderous marks. So there was no scandal, no chase after the murderer, no undiscovered crime. They faded when the doctor saw his brother again in the full light. And in the presence of others, his throat was clear, and the post-mortem proved that death was due to natural causes. So the matter stands still, and will. But where the house and its overgrown garden stood runs a new road, with neat red and white villas. Whatever secret it knew, if any, it kept discreetly. Ned Dent is morbid enough to go down the smart new road in the twilight sometimes, and wonder. And so ends The Phantom Woman. The Phantom Hag. The other evening in an old castle, the conversation turned upon apparitions, each one of the party telling a story. As the accounts grew more horrible, the young ladies drew closer and closer. "Have you ever had an adventure with a ghost?" said they to me. "Do you not know a story to make us shiver? Come, tell us something." "I am quite willing to do so," I replied. "I will tell you of an incident that happened to myself. Toward the close of autumn of 1858, I visited one of my friends, sub-prefect of a little city in the centre of France. Albert was an old companion of my youth, and I had been present at his wedding. His charming wife was full of goodness and grace. My friend wished to show me his happy home and to introduce me to his two pretty little daughters. I was feted and taken great care of. 3 days after my arrival, I knew the entire city, curiosities, old castles, ruins, etc. Every day about 4 o'clock, Albert would order the phaeton and we would take a long ride, returning home in the evening. One evening, my friend said to me, 'Tomorrow, we will go further than usual. I want to take you to the Black Rocks. They are curious, old, druidical stones on a wild and desolate plain. They will interest you. My wife has not seen them yet, so we will take her as well.' The following day, we drove out at the usual hour. Albert's wife sat by his side. I occupied the back seat alone. The weather was grey and sombre that afternoon, and the journey was not very pleasant. When we arrived at the Black Rocks, the sun was setting. We got out of the phaeton, and Albert took care of the horses. We walked some little distance through the fields before reaching the giant remains of the old Druid religion. Albert's wife wished to climb to the summit of the altar, and I assisted her. I can still see her graceful figure as she stood draped in a red shawl, her veil floating around her. 'How beautiful it is! But does it not make you feel a little melancholy?' she said, extending her hand towards the dark horizon, which was lighted a little by the last rays of the sun. The afternoon wind blew violently and sighed through the stunted trees that grew around the stone cromlechs. Not a dwelling nor a human being was in sight. we hastened to get down and silently retraced our steps to the carriage. "We must hurry," said Albert. "The sky is threatening and we shall have scarcely time to reach home before night." We carefully wrapped the robes around his wife. She tied the veil around her face and the horse started into a rapid trot. It was growing dark. The scenery around us was bare and desolate. Clumps of fir trees here and there and furze bushes formed the only vegetation. We began to feel cold, for the wind blew with fury. The only sound we heard was the steady trot of the horses and the sharp, clear tinkle of their bells. Suddenly, I felt the heavy grasp of a hand upon my shoulder. I turned my head quickly. A horrible apparition presented itself before my eyes. In the empty place at my side sat a hideous woman. I tried to cry out. The phantom placed her finger upon her lips to impose silence upon me. I could not utter a word. The woman was clothed in white linen. Her head was cowled. Her face was overspread with a corpse-like pallor, and in place of eyes were ghastly, black cavities. I sat motionless, overcome by terror. The ghost suddenly stood up and leaned over the young wife. She encircled her with her arms and lowered her hideous head, as if to kiss her forehead. "What a wind!" cried Madame Albert, turning perceptibly towards me. "My veil is torn." As she turned, I felt the same infernal pressure on my shoulder, and the place occupied by the phantom was empty. I looked out to the right and left. The road was deserted, not an object in sight. "What a dreadful gale," said Madame Albert. "Did you feel it?" I cannot explain the terror that seized me. My veil was torn by the wind as if by an invisible hand. I am trembling still. "Never mind," said Albert, smiling. "Wrap yourself up, my dear. We will soon be warming ourselves by a good fire at home. I am starving." A cold perspiration covered my forehead. A shiver ran through me. My tongue clove to the roof of my mouth, and I could not articulate a sound. A sharp pain in my shoulder was the only sensible evidence that I was not the victim of a hallucination. Putting my hand upon my aching shoulder, I felt a rent in the cloak that was wrapped around me. I looked at it. 5 perfectly distinct holes, visible traces of the grip of the horrible phantom. I thought for a moment that I should die, or that my reason should leave me. It was, I think, the most dreadful moment of my life. Finally, I became more calm. This nameless agony had lasted for some minutes. I do not think it is possible for a human being to suffer more than I did during that time. As soon as I had recovered my senses, I thought at first I would tell my friends all that passed, but hesitated, and finally did not. Fearing that my story would frighten Madame Albert, and feeling sure my friend would not believe me. The lights of the little city revived me, and gradually the oppression of terror that overwhelmed me became lighter. So soon as we reached home, Madame Albert untied her veil. It was literally in shreds. I hoped to find my clothes whole and prove to myself that it was all imagination. But no, the cloth was torn in 5 places, just where the fingers had seized my shoulder. There was no mark, however, upon my flesh, only a dull pain. I returned to Paris the next day, where I endeavoured to forget the strange adventure, or at least when I thought of it, I would force myself to think it a hallucination. The day after my return, I received a letter from my friend Albert. It was edged with black. I opened it with a vague fear. His wife had died the day of my return. And so ends The Phantom Hag. From the Tomb, translated from the French of De Maupassant by E.C. Wagner. The guests filed slowly into the hotel's great dining hall and took their places. The waiter began to serve them leisurely, to give the tardy ones time to arrive and to save themselves the bother of bringing back the courses. and the old bathers, the yearly habituates, with whom the season was far advanced, kept a close watch on the door each time it opened, hoping for the coming of new faces. New faces, ah yes, the single distraction of all pleasure resorts. We go to dinner chiefly to canvass the daily arrivals and to wonder who they are, what they do and what they think. A restless desire seems to have taken possession of us, a longing for pleasant adventures, for friendly acquaintances, perhaps for possible lovers. In this elbow-to-elbow life of our unknown neighbours become of paramount importance. Curiosity has piqued, sympathy on the alert, and the social instinct doubly active. We have hatreds for a week, friendships for a month, and a few old men with the special eyes of watering place intimacy. Sometimes during an hour's chat after dinner, under the tree of the parks, where ripples a healing spring, we discover men of superior intellect and surprising merit, and a month later have wholly forgotten these new friends so charming at first sight. There, too, more specially than elsewhere, serious and lasting ties are formed. We see each other every day. We learn to know each other very soon. And in the affection that springs up so rapidly between us, there is mingled much of the sweet abandon of old and tied intimates. And later on, how tender are the memories cherished of the first hours of this friendship, of the first communion in which the soul came to light, of the first glances that questioned and responded to the secret thoughts and interrogatories the lips have not dared yet to utter, of the first cordial confidence and delicious sensation of opening one's heart to someone who has seemed to lay bare to you his own. The very dullness of the hours, as it were, the monotony of days all alike, but renders more complete the rapid budding and blooming of friendship's flower. That evening, then, as on every evening, we awaited the appearance of unfamiliar faces. There came only two, but very peculiar ones, those of a man and a woman, father and daughter. They seemed to have stepped from the pages of some weird legend, and yet there was an attraction about them, albeit an unpleasant one, that made me sit down at once as the victims of some fatality. The father was tall, spare, a little bent, with hair blanched white, too white for his still young countenance, and in his manner and about his person the sedate austerity of carriage that bespeaks the Puritan. The daughter was possibly some 24 or 25 years of age. She was very slight, emaciated, her exceedingly pale countenance bearing a languid, spiritless expression. One of those people whom we sometimes encounter, apparently too weak for the cares and tasks of life, too feeble to move or do the things that we must do every day. Nevertheless, the girl was pretty. With the ethereal beauty of an apparition, it was she undoubtedly who came for the benefit of the waters. They chanced to be placed at table immediately opposite to me, and I was not long in noticing the father too had a strange affection. Something wrong about the nerves, it seemed. Whenever he was going to reach for anything, his hand, with a jerky twitch, described a sort of fluttering zigzag before he was able to grasp what he was after. Soon the motion disturbed me so much I kept my head turned in order not to see it. But not before I had also observed that the young girl kept her glove on her left hand while she ate. Dinner ended. I went out as usual for a turn in the grounds belonging to the establishment, a sort of park, I might say, stretching clear to the little station of Auvergne, Châtel-Guyon, nestling in a gorge at the foot of the high mountain from which flow the sparkling, bubbling springs, hot from the furnace of an ancient volcano. Beyond us there, the domes, small extinct craters of which Châtel-Guyon is the starting point, raised their serrated heads above the long chain, while beyond the domes came two distinct regions, one of them needle-like peaks, the other of bold, precipitous mountains. It was very warm that evening, and I contented myself with pacing to and fro under the rustling trees, gazing at the mountains and listening to the strains of the band, pouring from the casino, situated on a knoll that overlooked the grounds. Presently, I perceived the father and daughter coming toward me with slow steps. I bowed to them in that pleasant continental fashion with which one always salutes his hotel companions. The gentleman halted at once. "Pardon me, sir," said he, But may I ask you if you can direct us to a short walk, easy and pretty, if possible?
Certainly,
I answered, and offered to lead them myself to the valley through which the swift river flows, a deep, narrow cleft between two great declivities, rocky and wooded. They accepted, and as we walked, we naturally discussed the virtue of the mineral waters. They had, as I had surmised, come there on his daughter's account. She has a strange malady, said he, the seat of which her physicians cannot determine. She suffers from the most inexplicable nervous symptom. Sometimes they declare her ill of heart disease, sometimes of a liver complaint, again of a spinal trouble. At present, they attribute it to the stomach, that great motor and regulator of the body. This protean disease of a thousand forms, a thousand modes of attack, it is why we are here. I, myself, think it is her nerves. In any case, it is sad. This reminded me of his own jerking hand. It may be hereditary, said I. Your own nerves are a little disturbed, are they not?
Mine?
He answered tranquilly,
not at all.
I have always possessed the calmest nerves. Then suddenly, as if bethinking himself, for this, touching his hand, is not nerves, but the result of a shock, a terrible shock that I suffered once. Fancy it, sir, this child of mine has been buried alive. I could find nothing to say. I was dumb with surprise.
Yes, he continued, buried alive.
But hear the story. It is not long, for some time past, Juliet had seemed affected with the disorder action of the heart. We were finally certain that the trouble was organic and feared the worst. One day it came. She was brought in lifeless, dead. She had fallen dead while walking in the garden. Physicians came in haste, but nothing could be done. She was gone. For 2 days and nights, I watched beside her myself, and with one's own hands placed her in the coffin, which I followed to the cemetery and saw placed in the family vault. This was in the country, in the province of Lorraine. It had been my wish, too, that she should be buried in her jewels, bracelets, necklace, and rings, all presents that I had given her, and in her first ball dress. You can imagine, sir, the state of my heart in returning home. She was all that I had left. My wife had been dead for many years. I returned, in truth, half mad. Shut myself alone in my room and fell into my chair dazed, unable to move, merely a miserable, breathing wreck. Soon my old valet, Prosper, who had helped me put Juliet in her coffin and lay her away for her last sleep, came in noiselessly to see if he could not induce me to eat. I shook my head, answering nothing. He persisted. Monsieur is wrong. They will make him ill. Will Monsieur allow me then to put him to bed?
No, no, I answered. Let me alone.
He yielded and withdrew.
How many hours passed, I do not know. What a night, what a night! I was very cold. My fire of logs had long since burned out in the great fireplace, and the wind and wintry blast, charged with an icy frost, howled and screamed about the house and strained at my windows with a curiously sinister sound. Long hours, I say, rolled by. I sat still where I'd fallen, prostrated, overwhelmed, my eyes wide open, but my body strengthless, dead, my soul drowned in despair. Suddenly the great bell gave a loud peal. I gave such a leap that my chair cracked under me. The slow, solemn sound rang through the empty house. I looked at the clock. It was 2 in the morning. Who could have been coming at such an hour? Twice again the bell pulled sharply. The servants would never answer, perhaps never hear it. I took a candle up and made my way to the door. I was about to demand, "Who is there?" But ashamed of the weakness, nerved myself and drew back the bolts. My heart throbbed, my pulse beat. I threw back the panel brusquely, and there, in the darkness, saw a shape like a phantom, dressed in white. I recoiled, speechless with anguish, stammering,
Who are you? A voice answered, It is I, Father. It was my child, Juliet. Truly, I thought myself mad. I shuddered, shrinking backward before the spectre as it advanced, gesticulating with my hand to ward off the apparition. It is that gesture which has never left me. Again, the phantom spoke. Father, Father, see, I'm not dead. Someone came to rob me of my jewels. They cut off my finger. The flowing blood revived me. And I saw then that she was covered with blood. I fell to my knees, panting, sobbing, laughing all at once, as soon as I regained my senses, but still so bewildered I scarcely comprehended the happiness that had come to me. I took her in my arms, carried her to her room, and rang frantically for Prosper to rekindle the fire, bring a warm drink for her, and go for the doctor. He came running, entered, gazed a moment at my daughter in the chair, gave a gasp of fright and horror, and fell back. Dead. It was he who had opened the vault, who had wounded and robbed my child, and then abandoned her. For he could not efface all trace of his deed, and he had not even taken the trouble to return the coffin to its niche, sure, besides, of not being suspected by me, who trusted him so fully. We are truly very unfortunate people, Monsieur. He was silent. Meanwhile, the night had come on, enveloping in the gloom the still and solitary little valley. A sort of mysterious dread seemed to fall upon me in presence of these strange beings. This corpse came to life, and this father with his painful gestures. Let us return, said I. The night has grown chill, and still in silence we retraced our steps back to the hotel, and I shortly afterward returned to the city. I lost all further knowledge of the two peculiar visitors to my favorite summer resort. And so ends the story from the tomb. And so, lovely listeners, we conclude another eerie episode of Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales. Let's reflect a bit on the chilling narratives we've gone through today. Firstly, the Phantom Hag. This tale reminds me of the thin veil between our world and the supernatural. The spectral hag's terrifying appearance and the tragic death of Albert's wife highlights the relentless grip of the unknown. In this story, it leaves us pondering the physical and psychological impacts of such ghostly encounters. Next, the Phantom Woman. Gilbert Dent's tragic end underscores the dangers of obsession and the power of the mind to blur reality and illusion. The mysterious mark on Dent's neck that vanished and the ultimate demise in the haunted house reminds us that some mysteries remain unsolved and perhaps for a reason. And lastly, From the Tomb, where the story of a daughter buried alive and later revived by robbers explores themes of life, death, and the fragile boundary between them. The father's enduring trauma and the daughter's weakened state reflect the profound and lasting impacts of their harrowing experience. It's a poignant reminder of the resilience of the human spirit amidst unimaginable horrors, and a nice touch of luck. Each tale delves into the supernatural, revealing how encounters with the unknown can leave indelible marks on our lives. From ghostly apparitions to psychological hauntings, these stories explore themes of obsession, trauma, and the eternal mystery of life and death. Thank you so much for joining me, the Telltale, on this journey through the shadows. Keep your lanterns lit and your wits about you as you step back into your own world. Whether it's work or relaxing before going to sleep, I hope whatever you're up to right now is going along lovely and smoothly. Now, before I go, I want to thank my Patreon supporters. Firstly, my White Tea Warlord, the superstar that literally straps this podcast to a steam engine and circles it around the universe. Matto Star, you amazing, amazing friend of mine. Thank you so much for your support. I've been able to really pump up when it comes to some sound effects and some music this time around, as well as some music coming into the future. I've also, as usual, put your dollary-doo straight back into supporting the show by using Sooner AI. I'm also using ChatGPT. And DALL-E to create different kinds of visual artifacts and poster art and all sorts of cool designs in creative designs. So thanks to you,
I'm able to not even bat an eyelid when it comes to the monthly expense. So thank you very much, mate. I can spend freely when it comes to creative content. I'm also supporting Old Time Radio repairs thanks to your lovely support, where I can purchase RX Studio. Now, I've covered that in the past, but you know, I still want to bring it up because that's a major, major contributor to making sure the Old Time Radio episodes are clean and lean and no pops and cracks, well, as little as possible, that is. And it's all thanks to lovely like yourself, Matto, that go above and beyond and support the podcast. We're all actually lucky to have your support. Because without you and lovies like you, aka the Old Grain Forces or the White Tea Warlords, I wouldn't be able to buy RX Studio and carry out those old time radio repairs. So thank you very, very, very much. You really are epic. So Matto, have a fantastic week ahead of you, and I'll catch you next week. And next up is my White Tea Warlords. I'm lucky to have Lazookasaurus Rex, who bench presses this podcast into the moon and back, ties me on a string, and drags me around the universe. Thanks to you, Lesnar, I'm able to put your subscription, Lesnar, straight into, again, sound effects, but also, this time, into supporting Project Gutenberg some more, finding out some new and old stories to share, and any sort of expense incurred through the website. So thanks to you, Lesnar, I'm able to cover all that and more. You are a superstar. And my pal, I hope you have a wonderful week ahead as well. Thanks, mate. And of course, my second White Tea Warlord that I'm lucky to have, Joseph Schroeder. Thanks to you, you living legend, I'm able to cover ChatGPT costs specifically. I'm able to use the latest version of ChatGPT 4.0, which means it's even smarter, even quicker, and I can actually do more than, you know, 10 to 20 requests in an hour. I can really crank it up and pull in all sorts of research, papers, artifacts, news reports, review of news reports, summaries of news reports. I basically can speed up my ability to produce this podcast. So I'm really grateful. Thank you so much, Joseph. And I'm lucky as well to have a lovely set of Earl Grey enforcers that support this podcast. And here they are. Chad Warren, Just Heather, Sunshine Days, Juicebox Andy, Peter Raffaelli, Divided by Zero, Paige Kramer, Jane Gumnick, Michael Krupp, Jandy Prinz, and Seductive Smiles. Thank you, you living legends. Because of you, the lights are blisteringly on, the steam engine of this podcast never stops, and of course, I don't even have to think twice about running ads on this podcast ever. And nor that I would either, nor that I would. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful morning, afternoon, or evening. And till next we meet. Stay tuned for the Sooner AI outro as always. Thank you, legends. Catch ya.
Secrets untold, ghostly tales centuries old. In the shadows, mysteries unfold. Listeners gather brave and bold. Stories, fables, ghostly tales. In every shadow, truth.
Trent supporters. And a huge shout out to Matto Star, Lesosaurus, and Joseph. Have a great week.